Matters of Our Time, Laguna Pueblo author Leslie Marmon Silko has published a number of books that have been taught in thousands of college classrooms across the country, including Ceremony, Storyteller, Almanac of the Dead, Yellow Woman, and The Beauty of the Spirit, and Gardens and Dunes. Her memoir, The Turquoise Ledge, will be published in late 2009, and she recently finished a novella entitled Ocean Story that will appear after the memoir. In 2005, she received an honorary degree from the University of New Mexico, and she is a recipient of the MacArthur as a Genius Fellowship. Not too bad of an honor to get. A National Endowment for the Humanities grant, and numerous other awards that speak for themselves. She has been named, this is one of my favorites, a living cultural treasure by the New Mexico Endowment for the Humanities Council. This distinction seems to make her worthy of 24-hour protection and fiercely guarded no trespassing signs. And she has received the Native Writers Circle of the Americas Lifetime Achievement Award. Since I find myself rather speechless when I try to explain what Leslie Marmon Silko's writing has meant to me, and probably to you, I was delighted to find the following description by poet James Wright. In his words, "Now I have finally had the chance to read Ceremony, and I am moved to tell you how much the book means to me. In some strange way, it seems inadequate to call it a great book, though it is surely that, or a perfect work of art, though it is one. I could call Ceremony one of the 4 or 5 best books I have ever read about America, and I would be speaking the truth. But even this doesn't say just what I mean. I think I am trying to say that my very life means more to me than it would have if you hadn't written Ceremony." In another letter, he writes, "You are abundant. I don't mean cluttered or overgrown. Abundant, rather, as the seasons themselves are abundant. Again, I may be sounding literary, and that would be a pity, because I am trying to find words here for something that is very real for me. I am extremely glad and, in a way, relieved that you exist." Those of you who are familiar with her words no doubt share this relief. Those who haven't yet had the privilege of hearing them have that rare, perfect opportunity tonight. It is with tremendous pride, glee even, that I present to you Leslie Marmon Silko, a master storyteller of our present, past, and future.
Thank you. Welcome, everybody. Hello. Such a large group. I always worry about disappointing after such a wonderful introduction. But I found this is a wonderful program here, and you're so blessed to have a small university. You have a beautiful community here. And I've heard a few times mentioned that, well, there are no reservations in West Virginia. Well, that's as it should be, actually. And so all the more wonderful that you have this wonderful emerging, developing community that includes the tribal people and all the people here that are interested in the history of the land. And so this is a great treat to be in a place like this. I do travel and often to larger places, and I have to say that this is just a fine program, and you're blessed. And speaking of blessings, I have to say that I have been much blessed in my life. I was fortunate to be born in 1948, when a lot of the old-time people at Laguna Pueblo were still alive. And in those days, everybody in the community educated the children. And when I was a little girl, I had a little circuit that I would take every day, and I would go see my great grandmother, and when she got tired of me, and she would always tell me stories, and I would move on to old Aunt Susie and get some stories from her. And so I was much encouraged and indulged as a little girl to ask questions, and I listened. I was always a listener. And when the other children were off playing, I would hang around the adults, and I would be very quiet. And I could tell the way their tones of voice would change when they were going to talk, bring up a topic that maybe children shouldn't hear. So I'd get even more quiet so I could hear these things. And so I have to say that the beginning for me as a writer was hearing stories and hearing the history. Because everything was kept within the human mind and the human heart. All of the history, the philosophy, you might say, all of the different ways were kept by memory and in storytelling. And the narrative form was the way that this material and this information was kept. And in some ways, it's a much more a much easier way to organize information. And because everything is interconnected and you have a story to hold it together. And so when I went to the University of New Mexico, I just happened to take a creative writing course the semester. I was pregnant with my first son. My then husband said, oh, you ought to take a creative writing course. It'll be an easy A for you. And so I was looking for something like that. I had no sense then of being a writer, wanting to be a writer, though I loved reading and loved books and literature, my great-grandmother had been sent to the Carlisle Indian School, and Aunt Susie had been there, and they all believed that education, learning, knowing the world was the way to survival. And that was always the attitude that the people at home had. They were always welcoming strangers and new things so that they might get some information. And that's why I believe in the Native American Studies programs and in Native American literature and other studies that open up the wonderful information, the diverse information. If you think about it, we human beings only survive because of diversity. Because when catastrophic things happen and people don't know what to do, there are alternative ways of doing things, and so we must always encourage as much diversity as we can, because that's the way that human beings have survived up until now. And in a global community or a global society, it becomes even more important. And when I travel outside of the United States and in Europe or in Asia, I often find that what people outside the United States consider to be at the heart or core of what this place is are the indigenous cultures and the rural cultures, the people close to the land. And so the value of studying Native American or having Native American studies is far beyond anything. It's not something that a university should do for Native American people, for Indian people, although it's wonderful and important to the communities. But the people who really need to know are the non-Indian people, and the value of what our cultures and peoples have managed to do for thousands of years on this continent has value for everyone. So tonight I have some new work that I've brought, but I thought I would sort of get myself warmed up with by reading some older work. And I started out when I lived in creative writing, I found that I could just write short stories. It was just something, I guess that's what happens when you have an athlete, a swimmer, a runner, who's just born to be an Olympic champion. So I can't run and I can't swim. But I found that because I spent all that time as a child listening to the wonderful stories, and because Aunt Susie and Aunt Alice and my great-grandma had spent so much time with me, that the narrative came very easily. But poetry, even now, to me, is mysterious. And what I would like to do is just start out with the first and second poems that I ever wrote as a kind of warm-up. And I'm going to be reading from storyteller, and I had a pleasant surprise today when I met the president of your university, Mike Garrison, and he brought his copy of Storyteller that he still had from when he read when he was, 21 years old, I guess, or 22. He still had his copy of Ceremony, so that was good to see that. And it's still one of my favorites, because so much of the material reflects the old folks that were so wonderful to me. So I'm going to first read my first the markers in here, of course. I had taken my first trip to the Pacific Ocean, and I was so moved by being there. It was so very special. And so when I got home, I wrote this prayer to the Pacific. I travel to the ocean, distant from my southwest land of sand rock, to the moving blue water, big as the myth of origin. Pale, pale water in the yellow-white light of sun, floating west to China, where ocean herself was born. Clouds that blow across the sand are wet. Squat in the wet sand and speak to the ocean. I return to you, turquoise, the red coral you sent us, sister spirit of earth. Four round stones in my pocket, I carry back the ocean to suck and to taste. 30,000 years ago, Indians came riding across the ocean, carried by giant sea turtles. Waves were high that day. Great sea turtles waded slowly out from the gray, sundown sea. Grandfather Turtle rolled in the sand four times and disappeared, swimming into the sun. And so, from that time, immemorial, as the old people say, rain clouds drift from the west, gift from the ocean. Green leaves in the wind, wet earth on my feet, swallowing raindrops clear from China. And Aunt Susie had a wonderful story about Grandfather Turtle. She was often visited by anthropologists and ethnologists who were looking for theories about the land bridge. And so one day I went wandering over there. Whenever I saw a strange car, I knew that she was busy with people. And very often she was not credited. These anthropologists with all these great insights, they would publish, and of course they were Aunt Susie's, not theirs. But I would see a strange car in her yard, and so I would have to wait until it was gone. And one day I went in, and she said, "Oh, yes, that was Dr. So-and-so from the University of New Mexico, and they're trying to figure out about the Bering Sea land bridge and so forth." And then she told me the story that that occurred to her, and it was that the people were on the great traveling great migration, and they came to this great body of water, and they were very feeling very hopeless about how they could ever cross. And then just then Grandfather Turtle said, "Well, we'll help you." And so that was the next piece I'd like to read is the second poem. It's called Indian Song Survival. We went north to escape winter. Climbing pale cliffs, we paused to sleep at the river. Cold water, river cold from the north. I sink my body in the shallow, sink into sand and cold river water. You sleep in the branches of pale river willows above me. I smell you in the silver leaves, mountain lion man. Green willows aren't sweet enough to hide you. I have slept with the river, and he is warmer than any man. At sunrise, I heard ice on the cattails. Mountain lion with dark yellow eyes, you nibble moonflowers while we wait. I don't ask, why do you come on this desperation journey north? I am hunted for my feathers. I hide in spider's web, hanging in a thin gray tree above the river. In the night, I hear music, song of branches, dry leaves scraping the moon. Green-spotted frogs sing to the river, and I know he is waiting. Mountain lion shows me the way, path of mountain winds climbing higher, up, up to cloudy mountains. It is only a matter of time, Indian. You can't sleep with the river forever. Smell winter and know. I swallow black mountain dirt while you catch hummingbirds, trap them with wildflowers, pollen and petals fallen from the Milky Way. You lie beside me in the sunlight, warmth around us, and you ask me if I still smell winter. Mountain forest wind travels east, and I answer, taste me, I am the wind. Touch me, I am the lean gray deer running on the edge of the rainbow. What I did with Storyteller, I dedicated it to all the storytellers. The dedication is to the storytellers as far back as memory goes, and to the telling which continues, and through which they all live and me with them. So one of the stories I wanted to read, and when I wrote it, I tried to even though I was writing it down, I was trying to evoke a little bit of the way it sounded to be there, and when Aunt Alice told it to us. And so this is a little note that precedes it, a little story. It's from the Hamaha stories that the people tell in the winter. Aunt Alice told my sisters and me this story one time when she came to stay with us while our parents had gone up to Mount Taylor deer hunting. I was 7 years old the last time I had to stay behind, and I felt very sad about not getting to go hunting. Maybe that's why Aunt Alice told us this story. Hamaha, Adia. Once there was a young Laguna girl who was a fine hunter, who hunted deer and rabbits just like the boys and the men did. You know there have been Laguna women who were good hunters, who could hunt as well as any of the men. The girl's name was Cochininaco, and she used to go out hunting and bring home rabbits, sometimes deer, whatever she could find. She'd bring them home to her mother and her sisters. One time, she'd been hunting all morning south of Laguna Village, a distance past the sand hills, and she thought she would start toward home. She was just coming past Jemuya Mesa when she met up with a great big animal called Ixtrucuyu. Ixtrucuyu was some kind of giant they had back in those days. The giant Ixtrucuyu saw the rabbits Cochininaco had hanging from her belt. She had four or five big rabbits she had gotten that morning, and he asked her if she would throw him one of the rabbits. So she did, and he just gobbled it up in a minute's time because he was so big. He had a great big head, and he asked for another one and another one. Pretty soon she threw every one of the rabbits she had to this Ixtrucuyu, and he just swallowed them like they were little crumbs. Then the giant said, "What else do you have to give me?" And Cochininaco said, "All I have left are my bow and arrows and my hati," which was her flint knife. And the Ixtrucuyu said, "Well, you better give them to me." So she handed over her arrows and bow and her flint knife. And about this time, Cochininaco started to get scared, because whenever she gave the giant anything, he just took it, and he still didn't go away. He just asked for more. "What else do you have to give me?" he said. "All I have left are my clothes." "Well, give them to me," he said. Cochininaco saw this sandrock cave nearby. It was only one of those shallow caves, but she saw it was her only chance. So she said, "All right, you can have my clothes, but first I must go inside that cave over there while I take them off." The Ixtrucuyu wasn't very smart, and he didn't see right away that his big head would not fit through the cave opening. So he let her go, And Kochininako ran into the cave, and she got back as far as she could in the cave, and she started taking off her clothes. First she took off her buckskin leggings and threw them out of the cave. Then she took off her moccasins and threw them out of the entrance to the cave. She untied her belt and threw it out to the giant. Finally, all she had left was her manta dress and a short cotton smock underneath. She took off her manta and threw it out to the Istrukuyu, and she told him she didn't have anything more. That was when the Istrukuyu started after her, poking his giant hand into the cave, trying to grab hold of her. Kochininako moved fast and kept getting away, but she knew sooner or later that old Istrukuyu would reach her. So she started calling for the twin brothers, the hero brothers, Mao Sui and Uyuili, who were always out helping people who were in danger. The twin brothers were fast runners, and she called them, and in no time they were there. Mao Sui and Uyuili carry bow and arrows, and they each carry a flint knife, a hati, like the one Kochininako carried for hunting. When they got there, the Istrukuyu was scratching around the entrance to the cave, trying to get Kochininako. So the twin brothers each threw their hati, their flint knives, at the old Istrukuyu and cut off his head. That's how they killed him. And they split open his stomach and pulled out his heart, and they threw it as far as they could throw. They threw Istrukuyu's heart clear across. Those things could happen in those days. And it landed right over here near the river between Laguna and Powati, where the road turns to go by the railroad track, right around from John Paisano's place. That big rock there looks just like a heart, and so his heart rested there, and that's why it's called Yashka, which means heart. So that's one of the little stories that Alice told us. So I was very blessed to grow up there at that time, and with the folks, with the old folks there, and I remember that we had such a regard for the elders, and it seems odd today to think of myself as an elder. Of course, I always think that I'm still 20 years old. You know, we don't think about the passage of time too much, but the people at home didn't keep track of birthdays. The people at home would not limit you by the calendar or the clock, and which of course for me is a little bit of a problem because I still work very slowly like the old folks used to do, I find increasingly a great conflict between how rapid this society and especially like the book publishers, how they want to treat human beings like they're machines. And so something in me resists. The one speaks to you, I consciously would like to try to speed things up. In fact, when I finished my novel in 98, Gardens in the Dunes, I even tried to hurry myself to start a new novel, and it didn't work at all. Everything has its time, and so I work very slowly. Almanac of the Dead took me 10 years to write, I want to read from there because I've heard about the measures that people are taking to try to have the repatriation of some of the remains that were removed from West Virginia for the tribal Native American remains. And there's always been this kind of tension between the Smithsonian and many different museums and places with the remains of our beloved ancestors. And so here's a section from Almanac that pertains to this. The theft of the stone figures years ago had caused great anguish. Dark gray basalt, the size and shape of an ear of corn. The stone figures had been given to the people by the Kachina spirits at the beginning of the fifth world, present time. Little grandmother and little grandfather lived in buckskin bundles, gray and brittle with age. although faceless and without limbs, the little grandparents had each worn a necklace of tiny white shell and turquoise beads. Old as the earth herself, the small stone figures had accompanied the people on their vast journey from the north. Generation after generation, the protection and care of the stone figures had passed to an elder clanswoman and one of her male relatives. She prepares cornmeal and pollen sprinkled with rainwater to feed the spirits of the stone figures which remain in her house when they are not in the kiva. She lifts them tenderly as she once lifted her own babies, but she calls them esteemed and beloved ancestors. The stone figures were stolen from a kiva altar by a, quote, person or persons unknown, according to the official report. A ring of anthropologists had been crawling around the pueblos all winter, offering to trade for or buy outright ancient objects and figures. The harvests of the two preceding years had been meager, and the anthropologists offered cornmeal. The anthropologists had learned to work with Christian converts or the village drunk. The people always remembered the small buckskin bundles with anguish because the little grandparents were gone from them forever. Medicine people at all the pueblos and the Navajos and Apaches too were contacted. All those with the ability to gaze into still water or flame to locate lost objects or persons. All those able to gaze into blurry opals to identify enemies sending sorcery began a search. The gazers had all agreed the stone figures were too far away to be seen clearly. Far, far to the east. Years passed. The First World War broke out. The elder priests had all died without ever again seeing their little grandparents. Fewer and fewer remained who had actually seen the little grandparents unwrapped on the kiva altar, smooth stones in the swollen shape of female and of male. Then a message came from the pueblos up north. Go to Santa Fe, in a museum there, a small museum outside town. The spring had been wet and cold and only increased the suffering caused by meager harvests. The federal Indian agents didn't have enough emergency corn rations to go around, and reports came from Navajo country of people dying, starving, freezing. In Santa Fe, the state legislature was 2 years old and did not concern itself with Indians. Indians had no vote in state elections. Indians were Washington's problem. A muddy wagon load of Indians did not attract much attention. The Laguna delegation had traveled to Santa Fe on a number of occasions before to testify in boundary disputes with the state for land wrongfully taken from the Laguna people. The delegation's interpreter knew his way around. A county clerk had told him how to find the museum. The snow had melted off the red dirt of the pinon-covered hills, except for the northern exposures. It was early afternoon, but the sun was already weak as it slipped into the gray overcast above the southwestern horizon. An icy breeze came off the high mountain snowfields above Santa Fe. At the museum, the interpreter for the Laguna delegation left the others waiting outside in the wagon. The old cacique was shivering. They built a small pinon fire and put on a pot of coffee. Museum employees watched out the windows uneasily. Yes, there were two lithic pieces of that description, the assistant curator told the interpreter. A recent acquisition from a private collection in Washington, D.C. The interpreter excused himself and stepped outside to wave to the others by the wagon. The glass case that held the stone figures was in the center of the museum's large entry hall. Glass cases lined the walls, displaying pottery and bastions, so ancient they could only have come from the graves of ancient ancestors. The Laguna delegation later reported seeing sacred kachina masks belonging to the Hopis and the Zunis, as well as prayer sticks and sacred bundles, the poor shriveled skin and bones of some ancestor taken from her grave, and one entire painted wood kiva shrine reported stolen from Cochiti Pueblo years before. The delegation walked past the display cases slowly and in silence, but when they reached the glass case in the center of the vast hall, the old cacique began to weep, his whole body quivering from old age and the cold. He seemed to forget the barrier of glass form and tried to reach out to the small stone figures lying dreadfully unwrapped. The old man kept bumping his fingers against the glass case until the assistant curator became alarmed. The Laguna delegation later recounted how the white man had suddenly looked around at all of them as if he were afraid they had come to take back everything that had been stolen. In that instant, white man and Indian both caught a glimpse of what was yet to come. There was a discussion between the assistant curator and the Laguna delegation's interpreter, who relayed what the delegation had come to say. These most precious sacred figures had been stolen. The Museum of the Laboratory of Anthropology had received and was in possession of stolen property. The white man's own laws said this. Not even an innocent buyer got title of ownership to stolen property. The Lagunas could produce witnesses who would testify with a detailed description of the little grandparents, as the people preferred to call them. For these were not merely carved stones. These were beings formed by the hands of the Kachina spirits. The assistant curator stood his ground. The lithic objects had been donated to the laboratory by a distinguished patron whose reputation was beyond reproach. As the head curator was out of the office, the Laguna delegation would have to return next week. When some of the members of the delegation raised their voices and the interpreter had tried to explain the great distance they had already traveled, the assistant curator became abrupt. He was extremely busy that day. The Indians should contact the Indian Bureau or hire a lawyer. The delegation led the old cacique out the door, but the war captain lingered behind, not to whisper to the stone figures that the others in the delegation had, expressing their grief, but to memorize all the other stolen objects he could see around the room. Outside, the old cacique acted as if he had drifted into a dream. While the war captain and the tribal governor and the interpreter argued over starting another lawsuit, the cacique was rocking himself on his heels in a blanket close to the ashes of the campfire. The governor was right. Of course, they could not afford another lawsuit. So that's just a little section that I wanted to read because the return and the repatriation of all of these things that were taken, all of these items, so many of them sacred and alive to the people, that has to continue on, and so just to give encouragement to the people that are working to help get the ancestors' bones back where they belong. Say that's terribly important, and I feel a great solidarity with them. Almanac of the Dead covers at least the last 500 years of history in the Americas. When it was published, people were very angry at me. They were saying, "What's so terrible and violent and negative?" And it's only the history, you know. It's not something that I made up. But I think the most important thing that needs to be said is about the connection between the tribal people, the Indian people in Mexico and in Central America, even down into South America. There's one single great continuum. These borders that came later are artificial. And for years, the government, the federal government of the United States, the federal government of Mexico, have feared greatly that all the tribes of the Americas might join together. And I can remember in the 1950s when some of the people in some of the tribal people in the United States
tried to organize sort of intertribal exchanges. They were labeled communists. And so there's been a very concerted effort to prevent the recognition of this fact, which is that the Hopi people and the Hopi language is basically the language, and the connection between the people in across the United States border and people to the south is very strong. And so these recent years of this terrible, vicious, hateful campaign, actually it even started before Bush got in there, but it's been very strong, anti-immigrant but especially hateful and hate-filled towards the people from the south, who are Indian people, who are related to us. And so I have to say to everybody to not be fooled, that the people to the south are our relatives, they're our sisters and brothers. And whenever you hear people talking about they don't have a right to be here, how very wrong it is. And the anthropological materials, things found clear up in the mounds in very far north, in this part of the country, are archaeological evidence. But the strongest evidence, of course, is the connection between the Nahua people in Mexico and the Hopi people. And a very wonderful thing happened in March of 2006. The Southwest, we're now in our 12th year of drought, but it was much worse leading into 2006. And a group of religious elders at Hopi, and we should differentiate between tribal councils who may or may not be even worthy of recognition often, and the people who hold with the old ways. So anyway, a group of the Hopi people made a run, and they ran the older folks, the caciques, the priests didn't run but accompanied them, and they took a path that was known, and they started at Hopi way up in northern Arizona. And they traveled all the way to Mexico City on this prescribed path. And there was a certain way that they would go. And at certain places, they would fill their gourd canteens with a little bit of water from certain springs, from certain rivers. But the important thing was that the runners had to run all the way. And of course, at night, they had people accompanying them, and they would make camp. And so when they got to Ciudad Chihuahua, they picked up interpreters, so, you know, because as they got farther into Mexico. And I first heard the story from these interpreters from Chihuahua, non-Indian Mexican people who were in very sympathetic with the friends with the one of the Hopis. And so they were telling me this great wonder. So they continued on this prescribed path, and when they got to Mexico City, the idea was that they had to take this water that they had gathered all along the way and had carried all this distance. And you can get out a map and see how far it is from Mexico City to up to Hopi country. And when they got there, they were to take it to Tlaloc, who is the rain deity, both in for the Nahua people and also recognized by the Hopi people. And so these guys from Ciudad Chihuahua said, "Well, you know how polluted Mexico City is. Oh, the sky is just, you know, also they got to the big stone statue of Tlaloc was outside of the Anthropology Museum, and what the medicine men had to do then, the caciques had to do then, was they prayed in front of Tlaloc's statue, which of course was dug out of the ground and dragged there to the Anthropology Museum from someplace, and And they poured a little bit of the water there at Tlaloc. And then there were two very sort of polluted little streams that come together nearby. And so they went there and they poured the water out of the gourd. And then this part that the guys from Ciudad Chihuahua couldn't believe. At that moment, out of all of the pollution of the Mexico City skies, an eagle came out and circled and screamed. And there was a Hopi videographer, so they have this on videotape. But the more wondrous thing that happened was afterward, the path of the rain clouds and the rain that came in June of 2006 and the snow that came in the winter, fall and winter of 2006 and closed the Denver airport, closed the Albuquerque airport. And I after I heard the story, I watched how the storms and the clouds would come. And Las Vegas didn't get any rain, Palm Springs didn't get any rain, but the rain followed just the trail of the path of the prescribed of the run. So this sacred connection, this bond between the people of Mexico and the tribal people up here is very strong and very much alive and very important, because we have gotten great relief from the terrible, terrible drought. Last year we've gotten good rain. We're still, it's still clear that we're moving into a very dry cycle. But that was something that something wonderful that just happened between the people of Hopi and the old spirits down in Mexico City. So in Almanac of the Dead, I became fascinated with the Mayan and Aztec or Nahua books. They had wonderful books. They had a whole library, which Bishop Landa earned in 1540. The people, the wonderful books were screen books. They folded out. And when the Spaniards came, they were very upset to see books, because their whole angle was to go back to Europe and say, yeah, these aren't even people. These are like animals. And yet, many of the Spaniards who came to the New World, they were basically shuffled off to get them out of Spain. They were second and third sons who weren't going to inherit. And they often didn't read or write. And so they were aghast to find that these people are not, they didn't want to call the tribal people, but they had these wonderful libraries. And moreover, each book was revered as a living being, and they picked up on it. Oh, they're worshiping books. And so they burned them. And you know, it was years and years before I realized that in the Americas we had books and we had a great library. And So I started looking around, and there are fragments and bits and pieces of some of these books. And some of these almanacs were told the future. And so I wanted to see, I wonder if that really could be. And somehow you work with stories, these stories, I knew that. And so I worked and worked for 10 years on almanac. And in 1986, I had this intuition about an uprising against the Mexican federal government. So in 86 and 87, I was typing away, and about these Mayans who rise up, declare war on the Mexican government up in the mountains. And for a while, I didn't know where. And I thought, well, I got a map of Mexico out. And I looked up north. I looked all over. Where would these Indians be that are going to rise up against the Mexican federal government? And then I looked down and I saw the name of this town, Tuxtla Gutierrez. I thought, aha, it's got a Mayan word and a Spanish word. And so I named that town. And then after Almanac was published, I started waiting. Even while I was writing it, little things that I wrote in it sort of came true or happened. The section about the the videotaping of police torture and interrogations. You know, I picked up the New York Times a few months after I wrote that and found that that was exactly what was happening in Guatemala. And of course, the U.S. government has supplied the video cameras for these tapings of these tortures. But it wasn't until the, January 1st, 1994, picked up the newspaper and the Zapatistas had risen up in the mountains outside Tuxtla Gutierrez. And then I thought, that's how it works. Somehow, in working with the material, you can see the future coming. Because the Mayan people believed that time was alive, that a year and a day and a month had spirit and being, and that they would return. And you had to know them and know their story, because dangerous days would come, dangerous years would come. And if you didn't know the story of those times, then you wouldn't be prepared for the return of those days. And so that was part of what sort of got me going on that. So one of the characters who becomes a keeper of a few pages that didn't get burned, she goes by Old Yoami, which Yoami is the name that the Yaqui people call themselves. And there were bloody, terrible conflicts between the Mexican federal government, who basically, even before Hitler, had the Jewish people and gypsies and others that he slaughtered, where the Nazis used to have them dig their graves and then shot them. Well, that wasn't the first time that went on. The Mexican federal government was doing that into the 20th century with the Yaqui people, which would have the men, women, and children dig a trench, and then they shot them and killed them. And so there's a Yaqui community. The Yaqui communities, the Yaquis always did cross the border, and it was Robert Kennedy who finally got the band of Yaquis to settle in Tucson, got them federal Indian recognition. But those people fled Mexico to escape the slaughter. So this piece I'm going to read is dedicated to all the women who are freedom fighters all over the world. And this is a section called The Great Influenza of 1918. And I was thinking about the Great Influenza. It was one of the greatest natural catastrophes the world has ever seen. The count of the dead vary, but in 18 months, 20 to as high as 44 million people died of the influenza. So when you want to talk about, you can talk about hurricanes and earthquakes. But that, and so I was thinking about it, and I did a lot of reading, and I wonder if anyone got any good out of the influenza. And then I had this idea, the Great Influenza of 1918. This is Yoami. This is her account of what happened that she wrote. Of course, she's old now, but what had happened to her when she was a freedom fighter. Late in the summer, the pigs chew green corn cobs, and I wait for execution in the Alamos jail. I have been convicted of sedition and high treason against the federal government. They hate me because I am an Indian woman who kicked dirt in the faces of the police and army. They stand outside my cell and gloat over my death. Soon I must die because I have already lived too long. I have blemished their honor. Me, the short, square-shouldered woman with deadly aim. That's my title. In twos and threes, they come to stare at me. They relish the words they repeat again and again. Their daydreams of my hanging and dismemberment. My execution is delayed by their need for pageantry. Elected officials from other jurisdictions arrive. I am on display, an example to all who dare defy authority. Postponement is due to the governor's busy schedule. They don't miss a day outside myself. The police chief carrying the paper with Dave's cross off in charcoal. "Count them," he tells me in low tones. He is outraged because an Indian can read and write, while he, a white man, cannot. I laugh and call him barbarian in my language. "You will die, that is certain. All the others of my kind have already been sent to hell," he says. "My death is certain. I am not afraid to die. I am sorry to leave the people I love when the struggle is only beginning. I pray to God for justice, for myself and all our people. I pray for the success of the revolution." The day before my execution, the news reaches town. At first, the officials refuse to believe the reports of so many sick and dead. Influenza travels with the moist, warm winds off the coast. Influenza infects the governor and all the others. The police chief burns to death from fever. The jailer leaves a bucket of water and a bowl of parched corn. "The authorities want to keep you alive," he says, "until they recover enough to hang you." The jailer has bloodshot eyes. He says entire households have the dead lying next to the living, who are too ill to drag corpses outside. I laugh out loud, but the jailer reacts slowly. "Someone will come to hang you," he reassures me. But when I ask who, the jailer shakes his head. "He is tired this morning, or he would kill me himself." The town is silent. Church bells no longer ring the Angelus, and I listen with all my strength for the footsteps of my executioner. I could hear the big buzzards and smell what they ate with such relish. I was still locked up. Human scavengers followed, and I heard the sounds of looting. I did not think anyone would come, but then they came to loot the jail's guns and ammunition. The scavengers were afraid to open my cell because they saw my legs and wrists were shackled. But I told them the Blessed Virgin of the Indians had just worked me a miracle. I had been saved by the hand of God, and they must set me free. Noemi, a freedom fighter. Now I think I'd like to read you a little bit from the new work. I have to say that speaking of elders, and someday all of you will be elders, and you should value very much your experiences. I think in the present society we live in, our own personal human experiences are not terribly valued, and so there might be a feeling of discouragement of what could I know or what could I learn that in 40 or 50 years anyone else would want to know. But you see how the world changes, and you are a witness to things in your life and things in your community, and someday there is great value, there will be great value. And so you must remember and you must value all things and all experiences and not take for granted that everything will stay the same. And that goes for the things that are not as positive, and that we should also cherish the good things. And so very much of the material, for example, the story about the great influenza, my grandma Lily, her father was a well driller, and he was the one that came back during those years and had been to some of the Spanish-speaking, the land-grant villages in the Laguna Acoma area, and had said that there were so many, everyone was sick, and they were so sick, there was nobody to bury the dead. And I always remembered that when I was writing Almanac and writing that section, all of those things that the stories that I have heard. So listen, pay attention, and listen to, especially when it's a narrative, when it's a story, there's some very great power in the story and in assembling the story. So, and truly you can, by knowing and seeing the past, you can know the future. And so I would admonish you to value all of those things. Well, I turned 60 in March, so I decided, before I forget anything else, maybe I would start writing some of the sort of a sort of memoir, not really an autobiography, because that just sounds so, I don't know, I don't like to be fenced in. So I've been sort of, I have many, many pages, and so I'm trying to work to organize them. But I wanted to read a section, and I have different things here and there, and I also walk every day in the desert, and so it's called the Turquoise Ledge, because on my walk, I find these little pieces of they're not good turquoise at all, but I started to think about, well, where could these things be coming from, and I decided there must be a turquoise ledge. So, maybe I'll start with that first, and then there's a part called Ancestors this is a work in progress, so it's a little bit rough, but I think it might be interesting. On my walks in the arroyo, sometimes I find fragments of turquoise. As I walk along, I begin to imagine a great ledge of turquoise temporarily buried under the sand and rock. To find so many pieces of turquoise in the millions of tons of arroyo sand, pebbles, and rocks means the turquoise ledge must be large. Or is there more than one ledge of turquoise? One of the pieces appears to be solid turquoise, heavy with small flakes of pyrite scattered throughout. The distribution of the pieces of the turquoise ledge reveals its location somewhere below the place where the main road crosses the arroyo. I don't think the ledge occurs higher in the Tisquan Mountains. My speculations and guesses proved to be wrong. I walked up the arroyo above the place the main road crosses, and I found pieces of rock with turquoise streaks only a short distance from the rock outcrop where the cottonwood used to grow. Turquoise does not originate deep in the earth, as many precious minerals and gems do. Turquoise forms when certain chemical reactions take place during the weathering of surface minerals. Water is a necessary component of the formation of turquoise. No wonder indigenous people of the desert connected turquoise with rain and water. It wasn't just the color of blue or green. The surface minerals necessary for the formation of turquoise are copper, aluminum, phosphorus, and calcite. Turquoise is a hydrate of copper. Hydrate of copper indicates water in the latticework of the turquoise molecule. Iron can substitute for aluminum and result in a color variation toward green. Great-grandma Amalu's baby brother, Robert Anaya, gave me a ring of oval green and brown turquoise in an old Navajo silver setting. He was blind by then, and he used to cry from happiness as he embraced us great-grandchildren. We always stopped at his house in Pawati on our way deer hunting so he could bless us and pray for us, for our safety and success as we hunted deer. I cherished this ring from Uncle Robert Anaya, and I wore it every day. When I was 14 or 15, I was training a racing quarter horse filly. Every day after school, I went to her corral to work with her, so the saddle blankets and saddle didn't frighten her. I noticed the stone in the ring was a bit loose, and I knew I should take it off as a precaution. But one day when I was working with the filly, the stone fell out in the deep dirt of the corral. The silver setting and ring remained on my finger. I searched and searched the dirt in the corral, but never found the green and brown turquoise stone. Early in my collection of turquoise from the Big Arroyo, I noticed some special quality in a small rectangular piece of turquoise I found a while back. Over the years, I picked up the turquoise pebbles and fragments in the rock-streaked turquoise, but I wasn't really fully conscious of the stone. I needed almost daily contact with the presence of the pieces of turquoise in the wash. I vividly recall the small rectangular piece of turquoise, but it's because it seemed almost naturally shaped and polished for a necklace or ring. I wanted to use only the natural stone in my ornaments, no polishing or grinding. I looked around my house for this piece of turquoise. I remember putting it in a safe place, so safe that now I can't find it. But after that, an obsession began to insinuate itself into my brain. Even after I found three pieces of turquoise larger and nicer than the small rectangular piece, still I searched the house for the lost piece. What is it about us human beings that we can't let go of lost things? And so I'll stop here. There's more about up in the wash, but I want to read the section about the section about the ancestors. I don't remember what time I started, so I don't want to read keep you too long. But Grandma Lily that I'm talking about, and she's of mixed ancestry. She was not from Laguna. Grandma Lily married Grandpa Hank. Grandpa Hank's from Laguna. Grandma Lily was, I'll just read it. Grandma Lily was born in Los Lunas, south of Albuquerque. She was mostly Mexican and part Texas Indian. She wasn't sure which tribe. Zachary Stagner, Grandma Lily's father, ran away from his Texas family when he was 14. And had no contact with them again. Our cousin Joanne learned after much research that Grandpa Stagner's mother was a Texas Indian named Rhoda Touchstone. She died in Sweetwater, Texas. I used to wonder why he ran away from home at 14. Was it because his father, Stagner the German, administered terrible whippings? Someone on Grandma Lily's side of the family began the practice of whipping young children with belts and tamarisk switches. The Laguna people, who never used to hit their children, were horrified at the terrible whipping my father gave my sisters and me when we were small. Recently, I learned something about Grandma Lily's people, our Los Lunas relatives, and our family's terrible connection with whippings of young children. All these years, I thought I knew the whole story. But I was wrong. Long before I knew anything about the Indian slave trade in New Mexico, I had heard Grandma Lily's stories about old Juana, the Navajo captive who lived with them and cared for them when they were children. One Memorial Day when I was 12 or 13, Grandma Lily asked me to go with her to take flowers to Juana's grave. Juana died around 1920, when she was more than 100 years old. We filled old coffee cans with water. Then we cut some roses and lilacs from Grandma Angela's yard because those were the only flowers to be found. Grandma Lily drove us to the south side of Laguna Village and then down the dirt road near the old bridge across the river. A low wall of black lava rock was partially buried in the pale gray river sand that covered an ancient floodplain. In corners of the wall, dry weeds and scraps of paper and debris formed drifts. The graves were from the time when the Laguna people didn't use carved gravestones, but flat pieces of sandstone or slate or black lava stone. I seem to remember the remains of a few wooden crosses scattered about. She hadn't brought flowers to Juana in a while, but then that year, for some reason, she decided to do it. Grandma Lily took a little while to get her bearings among the piles of stone and small dunes of sand that shifted in the graveyard with every wind. Then she located the five dark lava stones the size of cantaloupes that marked Juana's grave. I helped Grandma Lily clear away the tumbleweeds tangled with other debris, and she talked about old Juana while we worked. Juana had been captured by Mexican slave catchers when she was just a little girl. Years later, when Lincoln freed the slaves, it was already too late for poor Juana. 30 years or more had passed, and she no longer spoke the Navajo language. She didn't know where she had been stolen from. Grandma Lily gave me the impression Juana came to work for their family when she was an adult after Lincoln's proclamation, because she had no place to go. Grandma Lily said Juana was the one who really mothered them, not Grandma Helen. Old Juana raised my Grandma Lily and all her sisters and brothers because Grandma Helen followed the practices of the wealthy Mexican women at the time, which meant she took to her bedroom as soon as she was pregnant and did not leave her bedroom again until 2 months after the birth. Grandma Lily had 11 sisters and brothers and two who did not survive, so Grandma Helen seldom left her bedroom. It was Juana who cared for them while their mother awaited another birth. Juana bathed them and fed them. Juana rocked them and held them when they were sick or scared, not Grandma Helen. Juana was in her 80s by the time Grandma Lily was born. I remember my great-grandma Helen vividly. She always dressed in black, a long black cardigan over a black dress. She rolled her own cigarettes from a bag of tobacco as she gossiped in Spanish with my grandma and her sisters, Lorena and Marie. I don't remember her greeting us or hugging us. She hardly seemed to notice us great-grandchildren. She was so different from our beloved Grandma Amo that we children were a little afraid of Grandma Helen. Grandma Helen was born to Josephine Romero, whose mother was a Luna, one of the founding families of Los Lunas, New Mexico. The Romeros were another founding family. Josephine Romero married a Whittington, the son of an English merchant and the daughter of the Chavez family. Grandma Lily always called her grandmother, Josephine Romero, Grandma Whip, because she wore a black braided leather belt around her waist, which she removed quickly and used as a whip for naughty children. My father remembers Grandma Whip, too. He said they called her Grandma Whip because as children, whenever they visited her, the first thing she did when they came into the house was to warn them not to touch anything in her house by saying, Grandma Whip, if you touch. The whippings that were part of child rearing in Grandma Lily's family, including my father and eventually my sisters and me, the whippings were a legacy from Grandma Whip and her family. In 2006, I was asked to write a foreword to a book about a corrido or ballad that was composed in 1882 in the Mexican community of Cubero near Laguna. The corrido was about a Mexican woman, Placida Romero, whose husband was killed and who was kidnapped with her baby by a band of Apache raiders. It is likely the Apaches chose the Cubero area deliberately because Cubero had long been the site of slave markets. Placida Romero was taken back to Chihuahua by the Apache warriors, where she was held for 49 days, and so badly mistreated that the Apache women felt sorry for the Mexican woman and gave her clothing, food, and even a burro to ride on her escape. Of course, the ballad written afterward made no mention of the compassion and considerable bravery of the Apache women who helped Placida escape. That angered me, because at the time they helped her escape, the Apache women and children were being murdered by Mexicans and Americans alike for the bounty on their scalps. Yet the Apache women who helped Placida escape did not let the genocide destroy their human decency. Here, my pages got out of order. I apologize. It's so typical. Okay, I may have to just finish. Well, that won't hurt. That'll make it short. It's not even here. This is like, you know, the nightmare. 22, 25, 27, 30. Okay. So anyway, it really made me angry. And so I happened to mention to my father that he was mentioned to my father that I was working on this project, and I said I really didn't know too much about Juana, the Navajo slave, the former slave that Grandma Lily used to talk about. And it was then that I found out the rest of the story, what I didn't know. And I had always thought that she had come to the family as an adult, but the truth was far more horrific. In 1823, the Spanish governor of the New Mexico Territory determined that the best way to punish the Navajo, the Apache, the Pueblos that didn't cooperate was to enslave their children. And what the Spanish had learned was that the people were fearless of death, but the thought of their beloved children being taken and put into slavery and sent away forever was unbearable. And so the Spanish territorial governor used the kidnapping and enslavement of Indian children as a means to control the tribes. And so there was it was a horrific sort of practice. And in my reading, I came across the year 1823 and determined, and in 1823, the Spanish governor had a special campaign against the Navajo. And that was when, I figured out the age Juana was when she died and realized that that was when Juana had been taken. And then my father told me the entire story, and it goes like this. Grandma Whip's brother must have ridden with the slave catchers. And it turns out that most of the merchants and mercantile people, mercantile men, went to these rendezvous where they traded Indian slaves. And so he had gone along, and he had gone along or somebody who went on one of these expeditions, but if they went and helped the soldiers, the civilians were allowed to take Indian children as rewards. And so four young girls were brought back to Grandma Whip's brother. And Grandma Whip's brother must have been just a terrible, terrible man. And there are accounts by other Indian slaves about how the Spanish and Mexicans like to beat them every day. And it really comes across as a straight out perversion when you read the descriptions of these beatings. And so these four little girls came back, and the youngest being Juana, who must have only been about 3 or 4 years old. And the Grandma Whip's brother was so terrible that their life very quickly became unbearable, and one can only imagine what help he did with the three older girls. You can only imagine. And so one day they put poison in his, and I imagine that they put poison in his whiskey, and they killed him. And but very quickly, before word could get around, before other, they called them maids and servants, but they were slaves. Before word could get around about this, they very quickly hanged the three young girls. And what I wondered, and what haunts me even now, was did they make Juana go and watch? You know, surely the hanging of these three young girls that poisoned this terrible man was to be an example to all of the slaves. And one of the things that my father remembered was that Grandma Whip had keys, and everything in her house was locked up. When they visited, Grandma Whip would have to take a key to open the cupboard just to even get sugar for the coffee. And so after hearing that story, I got to thinking, you know, my dad's interpretation, or what Grandma Whip said, it was so the servants couldn't steal things. But I decided it was try to keep the rat poison out of the sugar bowl. It's probably the real reason that she kept it wrapped up. So that's one of the little family, when you start working on a memoir or something like that, these things rise up. So that's the section in my memoir about the slave keepers in my background, and the story about Juana, the part that Grandma Lily didn't have the heart to tell me. And one, you know, when you think that when her sisters died, her last connection to the place she had been taken was gone, so that in that way there would be no hope that that she could ever get back. And yet she was so devoted and gave such love, was able to give such love to my grandmother and her siblings. One can only imagine how much she had been loved before she was speaking. So anyway, that's what I wanted to say to you tonight. I apologize for the lost page. It's quite typical, actually, for me. I'm sure it will turn up later on. But anyway, thank you so much for